The death of Rabbi Akiva. So, I suspect none of you were here yesterday, correct? Because yesterday, I'd said we would continue some of the issues, but if you weren't here, good. I want to start with an enigmatic passage in the Talmud. And I want to be honest, there's some passages in the Talmud which are difficult and some which are more difficult. This one is more difficult. Although I would say that this one borders on the more difficult to the impossible. So if you don't understand it, it's very good. If you do understand it, it may be reason for concern. There were five things that Rabbi Akiva commanded Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai when he was incarcerated in prison. So let's start and give a little bit of background from what we can to explain this. Rabbi Akiva was the teacher of Shimon ben Yochai, or Shimon bar Yochai, as he's called sometimes, is the student. Rabbi Akiva is in prison, and Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai comes to visit him. Omer lo, now it says that he commanded him five things, and by the way, those five things, we don't know what they are. The context over here in the Talmud is a number of different teachers said to their students, or fathers said to their children, like a last will and testament. Give them some orders, give them some things to think about, some things to do, some things to try to accomplish. Over here it says there were five things that he commanded him, and it doesn't record what they are. While he was there, he said to him, the student, Reb Shimon, the Rashbi, as he's called, said to his teacher, Rabbi Akiva, Rebbe, lamdeini Torah, Rabbi, teach me Torah. Amar, he said, eini melamdecha, he goes, I will not teach you. Omer lo, he says to him, eina tamalamdeini, if you don't teach me, and he omer lo yochai abba, I will inform, I will tell my father yochai, umasrecha lamalchus, and they'll give you over to the government, to the king. Omer lo, Rabbi Akiva says, Bini, my son, yosemi masha ego ritzeli nok, para ritzeli anik, more than the calf desires to suckle, the cow desires to nurse. Amar lo, Rav Shimon said to Rabbi Akiva, umi v'sakana, who's in danger? V'alo egel v'sakana, isn't the calf endangered? Amar lo, he said, im bikash lechanek, if you desire to be strangled, hitlo be'ilim gadol, then do it from a big tree. U'kishatam alamed es bincha, when you teach your son, lamdeu b'sefer muga, teach him from a carefully checked book. And that's the end of the passage. That's beginning to end. So was I right? It's somewhat obscure text, or it was clear to you. Let's review it a bit and at least attempt to point out the difficulties. Rabbi Akiva is in prison. Rabbi Shimon Yochai comes to visit him, which, by the way, that itself is a problem. Yeah, the Romans were not that nice. It wasn't like, you know, they had a Red Cross at that time, that they were visiting hours, come in, bring you some chocolates and stuff. And, I mean, Rav Shimon Yochai comes and visits him. While he's there, he says, Rabbi, teach me Torah. Okay, is that an acceptable idea? Well, students theoretically want to study, teachers theoretically want to teach. So therefore, for the student to come in and say to his teacher, teach me Torah, should be fine. Except for one problem, which we... What? Why? Well, there's one slight problem, and that we'll see in a moment. Why is Rabbi Akiva in prison right now? Because he was teaching Torah. So therefore, if he was sentenced because he was teaching Torah, so for Rav Shimon to come in and say, why don't you teach me Torah, may be an unfortunate request in this particular context. Okay, so that's the next part. He says, I will not teach you. So why won't he teach him? Well, he's in prison for teaching, which really, initially, there are two different approaches you can see. One is that he's concerned about himself, and two, that he's concerned about his student. Okay,
but so... what's the connotation with which you can teach it? You can't teach it from prison.
Well, with difficulty. I wouldn't say it's impossible. There are some passages in the Talmud where the community needed to know something, and they yelled a question through the prison walls, and Rabbi Akiva yelled back and gave the answer. So there were some times that he had taught. So over here, to try to ascertain what the difficulty was, is still in front of us. Next, After he says, I will not teach you, Rav Shimon says, if you don't teach me, I'm going to tell my father Yochai and report you to the government. What? But he's already in prison. What's he possibly going to do at this point? Yeah, okay. If you think about it a second, it almost seems crazy. But there's two levels to this. The first level is, what kind of student is this who's going to threaten his teacher like that? Can you imagine this? After class, you want to ask a teacher questions. I don't have time now. If you don't answer me right now, I'm going to plant cocaine in your car and call the police and have you. I mean, it sounds like an absurdity. In prison, it says. Doesn't say that. It says, in prison, havush bebeita asarin, incarcerated in prison. Well, so we'll soon see a second text where he gets arrested and some more prison information. He says, if you don't tell me, I'm going to tell my father, report you to the government, which then would indicate something about the father. So let me back up again. We know nothing about Yochai. The man is unknown at all. The only thing we know about him is that he had a son named Shimon. That's the only thing we know about this man. I think in the entire Talmudic literature, to the best of my recollection, he speaks only once. There's one passage I remember him speaking, where they needed to send somebody on a trip to Rome to represent the people, and it was a very dangerous trip because they could just arrest the representative. So one of the other, they suggest to send a certain rabbi, and the father of that rabbi says, you know, hold it. It's a dangerous thing. How can you send my son there? So send Rav Shimon by Yochai. And then Yochai says, hold it, my son is not, you know, he's also somebody's son. Like, how can you? So he said, no, he's Milumad Benisim. He knows how to do miracles. Which is part of the legend or the aura of Rav Shimon by Yochai, the author of the Zohar. But that we'll discuss tomorrow. That's not for today. So, Yochai, therefore, could be, again, we don't know anything about him. It sounds from this context that he may have some connections with the government. Maybe he's somebody who there are lines of communication going on. We don't know him being a scholar or not a scholar, but it sounds like he has some connections. And arguably, that would be the reason that his son was allowed to enter into the prison. Maybe he had enough connections to let his son in, get him in to visit, but that's it. You know, even connections can only take you so far. As they say in here, even protexia has its limits. But over here, this seems to be enough to get him in. So, when Rav Shimon is in prison, he asks him to teach. He says, I won't teach you. Then he says, if you don't teach me, I am going to report you. I'm going to tell my father to report you to the government. And again, so that point seems to be an absurdity. A, what kind of student is this who would threaten his teacher like that? B, what is the meaning of the threat? These guys are already in prison on death row. What possible implications going to happen from this? There is a suggestion by one of the commentaries, the Ben Yohayada, written by the Ben Ishchai, who suggests that it doesn't say I'm going to tell my father to report you to the It says, I'm going to tell my father to report you to the government. So he says, the government, in this case, it doesn't say the Romans. It's the government, the Hamalchut, the kingship. So he says, maybe when he says Malchut, he means God. So he says, if you're so afraid of the Romans, you're not even teaching Torah, I'm going to tell my father to report you to God. Which is also somewhat strange. It also, first of all, it presents another possibility. Who said Yochai is even alive at this point? Maybe Yochai is dead. Maybe he is this great sage who we never heard of otherwise. And that's what it would seem to be if you go in that approach. And say that you're afraid of this government right in front of us. My father report you to the real government and complain to God about you for holding back the knowledge which you have and refusing to share it. Now I think that explanation is very elegant. I just don't think it's true. Because in order for it to be true, then you would have to be a bit more rigorous and check if the word Malchut means God, or if the word Malchut in context like this generally means the Roman government. There are enough other sources where it refers to the Romans as the Malchut, which if you want to be consistent, therefore you'd have to change them all to mean God, and that doesn't really work. But as I said, it is a very elegant interpretation. He continues and he says, more, and he says to him, my son, which is itself interesting, you know, talking about Chil, my son, more than the calf desires to suckle, the cow desires to nurse. Who's in danger? Isn't the calf in danger? He says, if you desire to be strangled, do it from a big tree, and when you teach your son, do it from a carefully checked book. Now, one thing which is clear in this whole source is they're not speaking in a very clear fashion. In order to understand this, it's actually very simple. But all you have to do is, instead of listening to the words that are said, and that's normally what we do when we do interpretations, we listen to the words, we analyze the words. What I ask you to do instead is to picture the scene. When you begin to picture the scene, you close your eyes and you take a look, what's going on in front of you? Well, you see Rabbi Akiva in a prison cell. You see Rav Shimon Bar Yochai coming to visit. What else? As you pan back, what else do you see? What? Yeah. There must be guards listening. Think about it a moment. Would the Romans be interested in a conversation between Rabbi Akiva and one of his followers? Well, what was Rabbi Akiva's position within this whole... what was he doing in prison? There was a rebellion which was going on. This rebellion was a rebellion against the Roman Empire, and Rabbi Akiva was one of the leaders of it. So if one of his followers comes in, I think you can bet the Romans would be somewhat intrigued to know what exactly is being said. Furthermore, well, do the Romans speak Hebrew? How long have the Romans been in Israel at this point? The Romans have been here since the Greek period. Since the Greek period. When the Jews rebelled during the time of the Maccabees against the Greeks, there were a number of battles where the Jews defeated first the Hellenized Jews and then they defeated the Greeks themselves. But in order to keep the Greeks out, they then signed a peace treaty with the Romans, who came up from Egypt, and they kept the Greeks out. The downside of it was that they stayed. So therefore, this whole Second Temple period consists of basically three different parts. The first part, when they paid taxes to the Persians. The second part, after Alexander the Great captured Israel from the Persians, then they paid taxes to the Greeks. And then when they, after the defeat of the Greeks, they paid taxes to the Romans. They never really did have full autonomy. I don't know if people think about it so much, but the modern state of Israel is the first time that we have real autonomy and self-rule, not since the Second Temple, since the First Temple period, which is really, if you think about it, it's 2,500 years. It's an amazing thought. However, let's get back. The Romans, if they've been in Israel for at this point 300 years, you can be sure that not only do they speak Hebrew, they understand the dialects and they understand certain, shall we say, even slang and other ways of speaking. So it would seem to me that in this text, we note, in the very beginning, they're speaking clearly. At some point, it stops and they shift into some sort of a rhyme or some sort of a code. So it seemed to be clear that at the point that Rabbi Akiva does not want the Romans to understand what he's saying, he then starts to speak in code. And that's very simply, I think, the reason why we fail to understand the exact words of the text. I mean, and that's what I'm saying. It's said in a way which is code. So in order to really understand this, we need to see a little bit more. We need to understand the context. There's another passage in the Talmud. Yes. There's another passage in the Talmud which tells us what took place prior to this scene and what took place subsequent to this scene. So I think that by looking at this other passage, we'll be able to appreciate exactly what went on over here. So let's continue introduction as I find the page. The time between the First Temple and the Second Temple was 70 years. Between the destruction of the first temple to the building of the Second Temple, 70 years elapsed. I don't have any proof of this, but I would guess that when 70 years rolled around after destruction of the Second Temple, people probably began to sense that perhaps the history would repeat itself and the time for redemption was near. Second Temple was destroyed in the year 70. By the year 140, there was a full-blown rebellion which had taken place. It began around the year 125, 128, till the year 135, and that's the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. Again, Bar Kokhba Rebellion was a religious rebellion. Yeah, absolutely. It was one which saw Bar Kokhba not merely as a military or political leader, it saw him as the Messiah. That's why I'm saying it should be understood in religious terms. Rabbi Akiva was the greatest supporter of the rebellion. So arguably, they saw that the Third Temple was time to be built. There was therefore a certain amount of religious, I would even say fanaticism involved in it. But by the way, I do want to stress that according to the Talmud, the eventual failure of the rebellion was due to failures of Bar Kokhba, and it was due to failures that the political leadership and the religious leadership seemed to have gone in two different ways. And Bar Kokhba at some point began to believe his own press clippings, and eventually the rebellion failed. His own, I said press clippings, Masha Ketvu Alav B'Itanut. He began to believe what was written about him, and that seemed to be the failure. Now, let's just think for a moment. What was the major concern of the Romans while they controlled Israel? What was their number one consideration? What were they doing there? What did they want? So what's the answer? What?
Money.
It's as simple as that. Governments don't change that much. They wanted money, they wanted taxes. Hundreds of years the Jews are paying taxes, they live in relative harmony. In fact, I said the Jews did not have political autonomy, but they did, for the most of that part, they did have religious autonomy. And even if you notice, the main thing which happens with the Greeks, why they rebelled against the Greeks, was not because of a lack of political autonomy, it was because of a lack of religious autonomy. Okay? So the Second Temple was such where there was no political freedom, but there was religious freedom. Nonetheless, we begin this text which tells us that one time, Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, the first source we read was in Psachim on page 112, Kuf Yud Bet, and this one is in Brachos on page 61b, Samach Aleph Bet. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Pam Achat, one time, once upon a time, Gazra Malchut Harisha, the kingdom, and the wicked kingdom made a decree, Shelo Yasku Yisrael B'Torah, that the Jews cannot be involved in Torah. And you have to stop a second and say, what do they care about Torah? What do they care about taxes? Why would they care if the Jews are learning in their spare time, not learning in their spare time? Say, you got to pay this amount of taxes, you pay it, you don't pay it. You don't pay it, we kill you. You pay it, then everything's good. Why would they care what the Jews are doing in their own time? Why do this? Yes?
So why? They also
wanted
to kill Torah?
Well, at some point that happened. That's exactly my question.
Why?
So I think the answer is very simple. That's the source of the revolution. The Roman high command gets together. No, the governor from Israel comes in, from Palestine, comes in and says, well, there seems to be a little bit of a revolt going on. How little? Well, a lot of them are doing it. Why is this happening? It doesn't make very much sense. These Jews don't begin to think that they can rebel against the whole Roman Empire. It's an absurdity. How can a small band of Jews, okay, maybe locally, so then what would happen? The Romans would send hundreds and thousands of more soldiers, tens of, right, till they squash them. How? What are the Jews thinking? So then the, you know, your military or political analyst will get up and say, well, it seems to be a religious thing. Really? Yeah, it's the rabbis. They have this belief in a Messiah. They believe that they could, that their, you know, messianic age is coming, and therefore they can defeat the whole empire. So I said, okay, listen, we want to end this as quick as possible, so what makes the most sense? Make a decree that nobody can be involved in the study of Torah. That's it. Separate them from the religious fanaticism, and therefore things will go back fairly quickly. In fact, I would assume, and all this is guesswork on our part, but I would assume that as the Romans are talking, what percent of Jews, when they, if they're told, whoever studies Torah will be put to death, so what are the Romans are thinking? 80, 90% will forget about it. The masses will go back to life the way that it was, go back to work, pay their taxes, and, you know, people just want to go through life. They probably figure that a small percentage, anything from 5 to 10%, maybe 15%, would be the... And although realistically, I would suspect it's much smaller, more towards the 5 than the 15, would most likely go underground. These people would go hiding in the caves, go hiding, you know, in the basements and study. And at that point, the Romans most likely would create a secret police, inquisitioners, Gestapo, same people, their names get changed depending on the place and the time, go after the people studying, find them, execute them. Every time you find one of them, this would instill more fear within the masses. The masses would say, when the Romans say you can't study, they really mean it, and therefore, what are you guys crazy? And therefore, within a fairly quick period of time, we can destroy this rebellion, get the Jews back in line, paying their money and their taxes, and everyone lives happily ever after. So now, if you're Rabbi Akiva, how do you respond to this situation? Because on the one hand, Rabbi Akiva is a very old man at this point. The easiest thing for him to do would be take his best 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 students with him, hide someplace, continue teaching to his heart's delight till he passes on. But what's the problem? What's the downside of that approach? Is there a downside to that approach? Correct, but I would say more than that. He wins his personal battle, but he loses the war. Okay, I guess that's what you meant. Which means, let me ask this a little differently. We have had opportunities in our culture, in our history, where Jews were not able to live as Jews openly. Has that been a particularly efficient way of passing on our tradition? This does not take a great deal of analysis to come to the resounding conclusion, absolutely not. Look back in Spain. What was the choice that was given the Jews in Spain? Anybody know? Convert or leave, correct. Very often people think it's convert or die. It was convert or leave. Only catch was, once you leave, your property lost a lot of its value, which basically meant leaving with the shirt on your back and your possessions, but not that much more. Would mean if so many people are leaving, you can imagine how the housing prices or the real estate prices had fallen at that point. So therefore, the tortured choice that the Jews had was leave with very few of their possessions, or remain, but not as a Jew. Okay, that was a choice. Most Jews left. A large percentage, larger than you would have imagined, stayed. From the ones who stayed, that's when the Inquisition began. Though the Inquisition was for what they called Muranos, the Jews, actually the word means swine, for the Jews who made believe they had converted but really didn't. So they put the secret police after them, and those are the ones that would be executed. But again, I remember a number of years ago, in 1992, they had a whole series of articles about, because it was the 500th year anniversary of the expulsion from Spain. The vast majority of Jews said to themselves, we will keep our Judaism secretly, but it didn't work. It just didn't work. They completely disappeared. Till this day, there are families in Spain that know that they come from Jewish stock, but they've lost all identity. Some do, but the percentages are not that encouraging. I just read, I just saw Elie Wiesel's memoirs this week. Elie Wiesel. Yeah, I just saw his memoirs this week. And he wrote their story, which I believe I've seen him write in a different place as well, that once on a trip to Spain, somebody came over to him and said, do you read Hebrew? And he said, yeah. And he gave him a letter. And the letter said that my name is such and such. I think it was Moshe ben Avraham from this and this family. And we are Jews and we're being forced to convert. And this should be passed on within the family. And after he read it, he said, where do you get it from? So the guy said, Elie Wiesel, can I keep it? And that's an incredible document. He goes, no, this is my family's legacy. And 2 years later, he was walking in Jerusalem, and he sees the same. And a guy comes over to him, now with a long beard and peyote, and he says to him, I want to thank you. And he goes, who are you? I've never seen you before. He goes, yeah, we met in Spain a couple of years ago. But how many people actually left like that? A couple of years ago, when I was teaching this class, one of the students told me that when he was in university, he met this nice girl who wasn't Jewish. He went to her house for a weekend. And Friday night, her mother excused herself and went into the closet and lit candles. And he said, why is your mother doing that? She goes, oh, she does it every Friday night. He goes, why? He goes, well, that's what her mother did. So he said, where's your family from? And she said, Spain. To which my response was, well, you should go back and tell her she can come out of the closet now. But it's unbelievable. But the number of people that actually left are remarkably small compared to the people that thought they would initially. Rabbi Akiva understood that for Judaism to be passed on, it needs to be taught publicly, it needs to be experienced publicly, and it's a community experience. I think that anybody here who was brought up perhaps in a family situation where they were perhaps the only Jew in their school or neighborhood would not, if they want to pass Judaism on to their children, I don't believe that the same choice they would make for them. It's just extremely difficult to do it as an individual, all the more so when it's to be done secretly with a threat of death over your head. So, let's get back to the text. Rabbi Akiva, from the beginning, the rabbi said that once the Romans made a decree, the Jews could not be involved in Torah. It says then that Bo Pappas ben Yehuda, Pappas ben Yehuda is one of these minor characters in the Talmud. Actually a very interesting character, and there's a lot to say about him. But he is a minor character. Was no rabbi. He was actually, it seems to be, he was a thief. He was a small criminal. Guy, you know, hide in the cave someplace, come down, rob people. He comes down. Actually, what's really intriguing about him is one place in the Talmud says that one should not have a relationship with his wife the way that Pappas ben Yehuda had with his. Pappas says that he didn't have a very good relationship with his wife. He didn't trust her at all. He thought she was always cheating on him, so he would lock her in the house. He just locked her in all the time. So the relationship deteriorated so much that she finally snuck out the window and she cheated with somebody. But again, it says that she never would have had it not been the way that he treated her. What's really interesting about it is that there is a discussion in the Talmud about a man named Yeshu, who you may have heard of, and it says that Yeshu was the son of the wife of Pappas ben Yehuda and a Roman soldier. No, that's enough. What's interesting about that is that if it's talking about Jesus, this is much later than when the Christians say Jesus lived, which is about a different talk completely. The Talmud actually has at least two different people named Yeshu. One of them who lived 100 years before Jesus lived, another, or when the New Testament claims he lived, and another one who lived probably around 70 years afterwards. The suspicion is that the New Testament, the word Yeshu means the Savior. And the suspicion is that the New Testament simply is a composite of various different quote-unquote saviors who had lived, and therefore they took the stories from both and from more. But that's, as I said, that's not for now. But that's, once we mention Pappas ben Yehuda, it's too interesting just to leave. Pappas ben Yehuda comes down, finds Rabbi Akiva, umatsula Rabbi Akiva shahaya makhil kihilot birabim va'osek b'torah. He finds that Rabbi Akiva has gathered the masses together in public and is teaching them Torah. So what's Rabbi Akiva's response to the Romans? Public Torah experiences. Now, let's just think this through a second. Instead of what we thought, or what the Romans thought would happen, Rabbi Akiva, who anticipated the Roman plan, what he says is, no, we have to do this publicly. Why publicly? Well, first of all, the strength in numbers. As Rabbi Akiva's students would come to a town and try to gather the people together, the initial response most likely was, what are you talking about? They said, Rabbi Akiva's coming, the legendary, the great Rabbi Akiva's coming to town, he demands everybody comes, but they won't kill everybody. Correct? Why won't they kill everybody? Because then there's no taxes. So the leaders, Rabbi Akiva's students, assure the people, you will not be killed, the only people who are in trouble are the leaders. Rabbi Akiva's taking that, right? That's upon himself, and he demands everybody come. So everybody really comes. Rabbi Akiva, most likely, therefore, in like the last months of his freedom, is going from town to town through Judea, Samaria, going from town to town, pulling in, gathering the masses together. The Romans, of course, probably find out about it a little bit late, coming to town after. And what's happened now, again, on a psychological level, it's beautiful. Because what now has happened? Everyone's together. You have more than that. Rabbi Akiva's going to get caught sooner or later. Is that clear or not necessarily? Yeah, it's sooner or later he's going to get caught. I mean, that's to me is absolutely clear. Correct. Rabbi Akiva, again, you see right here that he's a political leader. You just listen to what he's doing. He realizes he's going to get caught. But if he got caught hiding in a cave with 20 students, the masses will say, well, the man's an idiot. The Romans say you can't do it, but now it's completely different. Now they're all involved with it, which means emotionally.
Which,
and everyone now is a part, which means sooner or later the Romans are going to catch him and drag him away publicly, and therefore Rabbi Akiva will become a martyr. Now, as far as PR goes, it's very bad public relations. That's very bad for the Romans. But Rabbi Akiva realizes, therefore, is that he has to energize the community, bring them together, and they cannot stop their involvement in Torah. So let's now continue. Pappas ben Yehuda comes down and sees Rabbi Akiva publicly together teaching. And he says to him, Akiva, iyata mityare mipnei malchut. By the way, the word is malchut again over here, which is what I was referring to before. Aren't you afraid of the government? Amar lo, Rabbi Akiva says, amsholach ha-mashal amada v'doma. Let me give you a comparison to what this should be compared. A mashal. L'shu'al she'yam ha-halecha gav ha-nahar. There was a fox walking on the banks of the river. V'ra'ad dagim she'yu mitkapitzim mimakom l'makom. And he sees fish traveling from place to place. How do fish travel? Don't say by swimming. In schools. Right? Dagim, plural. Schools of fish. Schools of fish traveling from place to place. Why are you guys running from place to place? Because of the nets which are cast for us by the humans. Do you want to come up to dry land? We'll live together, the fox says to the fish. We'll come live together in dry land the way that our ancestors once lived together. Perhaps an implication of evolution. I don't know. Omrulo, the fish say back to the fish, what if we are afraid in the place where we live, right? In the place of water. All the more so in the place of our deaths. So this is particularly interesting, because within the comparison over here, you see that Rabbi Akiva is talking about the schools of fish, publicly, together, going from place to place. Yeah, we have to move from place to place, but this idea of us moving on to the dry land, going up and living in the caves with the robbers, that's not going to work because that's a place of death. The water is Torah, the water is our life, the Torah is our life. Telling us to stop doing what we're doing, to forfeit the communities and to come up on the dry land, is basically suicide on a national level, and that's what Rabbi Akiva is responds. Now, let's go back to the Romans a second. We know that the Romans are going to catch him. What are they going to do with him when they catch him? Put him in jail, right? I don't know to what degree the Romans felt the need. Yeah, due process, you know. Oh, we didn't give him his rights, you know, let's release him. I mean, that doesn't really resonate, right? Correct. But now the Romans have a problem. They have a problem because Rabbi Akiva has energized the entire community. Everybody now is studying publicly. The Romans said it's a penalty of death, and everybody is defying them because of Rabbi Akiva. Which is, by the way, is an incredible testimony to the power of one person. One person can rebel against a whole regime. And that's what Rabbi Akiva did over here. So what are the Romans going to do? The Romans, let's remember, they are somewhat barbaric. They are pagans still at this point. And the Romans, I would assume, come to this, they'll have him in prison, but they come to this conclusion that they will have to execute him. But not only that, they will execute him publicly, and they will do it in the harshest, most horrific way imaginable. They want all the people they're watching, as if to say, this is your great leader. They're going to torture him to the point that they will break the hearts of all the people that are witnessing this. On the other hand, Rabbi Akiva is at this point, this incredible figure, mythical, legendary in his own life. The masses now are doing, they can't stop them. You can imagine the students now saying to them, you can't stop or Rabbi Akiva will die for nothing. Now all the people are emotionally involved within the fight. It says, Lo hayu yomim mu'atim ad shetafsu l'Rabbi Akiva. A short time passed by and they caught him. V'chavshuhu b'veita asurim. and they put him in prison. So here you go, Rabbi Akiva's in the Roman prison, and this is where our last text was introduced. V'tafsu l'papus ben Yehuda v'chavshu etzlo. Not only that, Papus got arrested also. He was a robber. He got arrested also. Amar lo Papus. Papus says, excuse me, Amar lo. Rabbi Akiva says, Papus, mi aviecha lachan? Papus, what are you doing here? I thought you had this great plan. You go hide up in the caves. Amar le, and if you listen very carefully to the words here, you get the sense of the love and admiration that the masses had for Rabbi Akiva. Let me just say one more word before I read this his response. I would assume that even in prisons, there's a hierarchy. The lowest level in prisons are the people, the child murderers, the child rapists, and things like that. After that, you have different types of crime. Different people are more respected, less respected. In a society, certainly like this, the highest level would be the political prisoners, the people that are rebelling against the regime. I think a man like Gandhi or Mandela, Sharansky, Martin Luther King, people like this, when they were in prison, very often they had an incredible amount of respect by the other prisoners because they were there because of an idea. And very often an idea that other people believe. The other people may be criminals. The other people may be murderers and rapists and robbers and whatever. But they knew that this person who there was with them was a person of a superior moral standard. You hear these words when Papa speaks. Rabbi Akiva says, what are you doing here? Didn't you have a great plan? Amar Leh, he says, Ashrecha Rabbi Akiva. Fortunate or praised are you, Rabbi Akiva. Shenit Pasta al Divrei Torah, who was arrested for something significant, for studying Torah. Oilo le Papas, woe unto Papas, Shenit Pasta al Dvorim Betelim, who was caught for stupid things, for insignificant things. Again, you hear it very, very clearly. Bishasho tziyat Rabbi Akiva lahariga, when the moment came for the execution, zman kriyat shmaya, it was a time to say shema. V'hoyu sokin pisaro b'masrokot shel barzel, and they ripped his skin off with combs of metal. They skinned him alive. V'hoyu makabel of ol malchut shemayim, and he accepted upon himself God's oneness. He accepted upon himself O Malchut Shemayim, the kingship of God, which is in this context of the Gemara, what it means is he was saying Shema. Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Achad. Omru lo Talmidav Rabbeinu Ad Kan. His student said, Rabbi, even here, even in this situation, Amar lehem kol yamayiti mitzdar al pasuk zeh. My whole life I was a little sorry about this verse. When it says you have to love God with all of your soul, it means even to the point of losing your life. Which is, by the way, when you say the verse in Shema, love God with all your life, all your heart, all your soul, what you should be thinking about, even to the point of death. Amarti, matay yavo liadi b'akaymenu. If I ever have the opportunity, will I keep it? And now that I have the situation, I'm not going to fulfill this. He said, till his voice left, his soul left him as he said the word echad. The voice comes out of heaven and said, whose soul left him echad. The text goes on a little bit, but let's. This is sufficient. A couple of things I want to point out. First of all, to understand what really happened over here. It said it was time to say Shema. When is the time to say Shema? So you say Shema in the morning, you say Shema in the evening. Before you go to sleep, there's a Shema. Also, I don't know if you know this, there's an idea that you say Shema before you die. But you can't say that. Why not? Because this is the source. So that would be circular. But I think there's something else going on here. I think when it says the time to say Shema, it doesn't mean it in terms of the time of day. I think it means the time of history. To explain this, think for a moment. The idea of the Shema is accepting upon ourselves one God. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. There is one God. The basic pledge of allegiance of monotheism. One God. So why does it start off saying Shema Yisrael? Listen, O Israel. Shouldn't I be saying it to myself? Who is Israel? Who is Yisrael? So to understand this is not a simple idea. Yisrael is not perhaps what you think it is. Yisrael is not simply the Jewish people, or it's the Jewish people in a much more complicated form than you ever would have thought. The mystics speak of something called Knesset Yisrael. It is the sum total of all the Jews who ever lived. For example, and I'm about to speak theology, not politics, who owns the land of Israel? Who's the owner of it? So you could say God. God gave the land of Israel to the people. Which people? Knesset Yisrael. All the Jews who've ever lived. Who did God give the Torah to? All the Jews who ever lived. Past, present, and future. If every single Jew in the world today would get together and say, we relinquish our rights to the land of Israel. We no longer want it. Is that binding on our children? Not at all. We are just caretakers. I mean, this idea in Judaism, the same thing about our souls, our bodies, we're caretakers. That's our job, to take care of the land, try to live here, settle it. Again, this has nothing to do with politics. I did not say anything about perhaps giving land for peace, not giving land for peace. That's a completely separate, that's a pragmatic discussion. What this would say is that even if one chose to give land for peace, there would still be rights retained, theological rights retained to that land. The land belongs to every single Jew. When I say Shema, I'm saying Shema Yisrael, listen, to every single Jew who's ever lived, past, present, and future. Which means if Rabbi Akiva is able to say Shema with real conviction, Jews hundreds and thousands of years in the future will be inspired by this Shema. Why was it the time to say Shema? Don't you see how easy it would have been for people to have given up at that point? The Second Temple was destroyed, which is very difficult for us to even imagine what that meant socially for the people. Temple's destroyed. Jerusalem's destroyed. People could have given up. Bar Kokhba, okay, there's light, there's hope. There's going to be rebellion. That's destroyed. Rabbi Akiva is probably looking around saying that it's going to be very simple for these people to lose their connection to Judaism. The Romans are saying, whoever studies them will be put to death. Rabbi Akiva says, it's time to say Shema. He gets up publicly and says, Shema Yisrael, Shem Elokeinu, Shem Echad. And if you really think about it, when Rabbi Akiva was in prison, as far as I can tell, he was working on two things. He knew that the Romans are going to try to torture him. In fact, there's a beautiful passage which tells over the same story from a different perspective in the Jerusalem Talmud. It tells us that as the Roman executioner was ripping the skin off of him, Rabbi Akiva is having this dialogue with his students. And the guy says, what are you? Some kind of miracle worker? Or are you some kind of a magician? I'm torturing you. I know. I'm a profession. I've killed many people. You're supposed to be screaming now. That was the plan. The plan was to torture him, to humiliate Rabbi Akiva in front of the masses. And Rabbi Akiva keeps on talking, giving his lecture. But by the way, if this is difficult to understand, there are people that you can pay $500, perhaps $5,000. They'll teach you how to walk on fire, how to lay down on nails. There is a concept of being able to transcend pain. Rabbi Akiva is sitting in his prison. He's working on two things. He knows that they are going to try to torture him. So he has to focus on the mission at hand and forget about the pain. Second thing is he's working on his last speech. He knows the Romans are going to gather him together and try to publicly humiliate him. So therefore, what they're giving him is an opportunity to have one last lecture to his students. He's not going to give in to the pain there. He has no choice about this. The Maharami Rutenberg, one of the great Ashkenazic authorities in the Middle Ages, a man himself who had personal tragedy, he was kidnapped and held ransom. And he demanded of his students not to pay the ransom. He spent the last, I think, 12 years of his life in prison. He once said, and this came after viewing the records of the Crusades, he says, any person who decides they're going to die for the sake of God will not feel it. Again, I can't guarantee you it's true, and I'm not asking you to check it out. But what he's saying is that the point that you get so connected to something on a spiritual level, you're no longer functioning on a physical level, and you don't feel anymore. The prime example would be Rabbi Akiva. So, we now understand what Rabbi Akiva's plan was beginning to end. Rabbi Akiva knew he'd be killed. He knew he'd have a last opportunity to speak to people. We see the speech that he gives where he tries to uplift the people. And let's face it, till this very day, there are people who get the strength to die by saying the Shema beforehand, and Rabbi Akiva is their example. Unfortunately, we've had many thousands of people, millions of people, going from the Crusades, the Chelmsford massacres, through the Holocaust, and there are soldiers in the front in Israel today who, you know, when that bullet hits them, they say Shema Yisrael out of the inspiration of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva did teach people how to die. So now let's go back to our first passage and try to see what happened there. Rabbi Akiva is in prison. Rav Shimon ben Yochai comes to visit him. Rav Shimon ben Yochai says, "Rabbi, teach me Torah." How did he get in? Let's go with the line that we had before, that his father has connections. He gets into the prison. He sees his great master, Rabbi Akiva, and says, "Okay, Rabbi, teach me." Why does he think that he'll teach him? Because here's a man who's not afraid of anything. The last time he saw Rabbi Akiva, he was up there in front of the masses, defying the whole Roman Empire, you know, right in their face, as they say in America. Right there, teaching everybody. So Rav Shimon ben Yochai comes in and says, "Teach me." "Are the guards around?" "Sure they are." He goes, "Rabbi Akiva's not afraid of guards. He's not afraid of anybody. He's seen him do it." He says, "Teach me Torah." He goes, "No, I won't teach you Torah." So what's the first thought that goes in Rav Shimon's mind at that point? It must be that Rabbi Akiva is a broken man. They got to him. The Romans tortured him a little bit, kicked him around a little bit, beat him a little bit, and that's it. He won't teach anymore. So he says, "Rabbi, if you don't teach me, I'm going to tell my father about this and report you to the government." What will his father tell the government? At this point, we didn't do that. What? That he's no longer teaching. If he's no longer teaching, what will the Romans do? Free him. Why free him? Because then they've solved their public relations problem. They'll say, "Look at your pathetic old man. Look at Rabbi Akiva. This is your leader. He's broken." Which means humiliating him that way probably would have even been better than executing him. The Romans understand. Rav Shimon ben Yochai says, "If you don't have the guts to teach me, I'm going to tell my father, report to the government, let you go." So now we understand. It's not that he was threatening his teacher. He's saying, "You don't deserve the respect that all the people out there have for you." So what does he say? At this point, he goes into the code. He doesn't want the people listening. He says, "More than the calf desires to suckle, the cow wants to teach. I haven't changed at all. As much as you want to study, I want to teach." So Shimon Yochai says, "But who's in danger? Isn't the calf in danger?" Which means, if you think that the problem is not teaching me, right? The problem is teaching me. The problem is much more severe if you don't teach me. Calf without any sustenance. Rabbi Akiva says, "You don't get it. If you desire to be strangled, do it from a big tree." What's he saying? As we like to say, get the most bang for the buck. They're going to kill me. I'm not going to give them the opportunity to do it here. They got this big public execution planned. I'm working on my speech for that. Not here, not now. So in essence, Rabbi Akiva really has told him exactly what he has in mind, but he can't have the Romans understanding it. Because if the Romans understand what he's saying, then the Romans will cancel him, just kill him privately. Rabbi Akiva is banking on this, that the Romans will give him one more opportunity to inspire the people, and it worked. The last line in the story is, when you teach your son, teach him from a very carefully checked book. From a very carefully checked book. To understand that line, we'll have to continue tomorrow.